Once again, my name is Sammy Mayer, for those of you who are new. And my topic for today, under the general heading of Two Homes Have I, is speech, silence, and action. And we'll talk about that a lot more later on. But first of all, I want to just recap a little bit from yesterday. And I want us to sing as our devotional again the song that we sang last night at the Vespers. Susan, I don't know what her last name is, but she said, you know, that song we sang at that session ought to become a regular at Holden. And I told that to Jody Kretzman last night, and he said, I think that would be a great idea. Maybe we'll start that sometime at noon. It was a song that we sang very often at our new wine exchange meetings where we were planning for the future of all these edge of the church groups. And it was a song that was very precious to our family, too. Anyway, I ran across a quotation that I think is so appropriate for us by William Butler Yeats. He says, a human being is no better than a scarecrow, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless the soul has learned to clap its hands and sing. And we certainly have been doing a lot of that at Holden this whole week with Pam Smith and with George James Harris and with the flautists and the dancers and all of these wonderful musicians. And so we want to start once again with this song. Our topic yesterday was had to do with A Dance in the Valley of Dry Bones, and transliterated, that could mean an infection of life in a world of dying. And so we need to, I think we need to understand as the church that that's what we're about. We are a church in mission. And that means an outflowingness of our activities. We are in a people business, is what we said. So I'd like to, and especially, you know, when we think about our Rainbow Week, these last couple of weeks, I think that's just extremely important. So let me play the song and turn to page number 81. After you hear it.
Sing this.
those of you who weren't here yesterday, that was so precious to me, especially because I was telling the story of how my husband at one of our meetings of the New Wine Exchange and another man, right before he died, danced around the entire hall of the retreat center that we were meeting at to this song. And it just has meant so much to me, and I thought, what an infection of life in the midst of dying. You know, it was just so wonderful. And subsequent to that, there was a memorial service in Cleveland, Ohio, and one of our very good friends did a calligraphy in a picture, and I had that song on my wall. So it's just, I wanted to share it with you. The other thing I want to share with you before I go into our topic for today is that we talked about the church in mission as a flowing out. The church in mission to the church. We didn't go into all of these aspects, but I brought along from home some of the, what we call the mission affirmations. And they were adopted actually by the Missouri Synod in around 65. They have been redone in inclusive language. And this document was shelved after the controversy. It was just too progressive in terms of how we saw our outreach and our reciprocal learning processes with society, with one another, with the whole person. And if any of you would like to pick up a copy, you're very welcome to it before you leave. So I'll just put those here, and you can pick it up then later on. My topic for today is taken from this book. You know, you get your ideas a lot from other people when you're searching around for things to talk about. It's a book by Virginia Rainey Mollenkott, who is a professor of literature at the William Patterson College in New Jersey. Just a very insightful human being. And she called this book Speech. Silence. And she identifies, she explains those words in yet other terms. Speech is the get ready stage. Silence is the get set stage. And action is the go stage. You know how our kids play these games? Get ready, you know? Get set, and then they go. And I think it's just incredible imagery for us today. So I have based my thoughts and my reflections that I want to share with you today on that particular book. She said that over a period of 15 years that she developed a whole movement away from her world of ideas, of books, and of words, which was her world as a literature professor. That she moved into a learning about silence and then about action after the silence. And she said that what developed out of that struggle of hers and that search was a whole new lifestyle in which speech, silence, and action were an ever-renewing cycle. And she also said that one without the other leaves the process bereft and without loss. And I think that as we talk about it a little bit more, you'll come to understand what she means by that. I want to just read you a little quote of hers that I think explains this process that she went through very well. And I think that we in the U.S., and as we cross cultural boundaries, we too will find this process very helpful. She said, "Even my interior life is structured according to this dynamic of
Get ready, set, go. Speech, silence, action. I continue whenever possible to feed my spirit with great words from the past and present, the Bible, Christian and non-Christian mystics, classical literature, contemporary literature. So the word remains very central as a stimulant and a preparer, the get ready stage of my life experiences. Then, when I begin to pray, for the first few minutes, speech continues in the foreground, aloud or silently. Speech continues in the foreground. Aloud or silently, I speak and feel my concern for others and myself. But even more important to me are the moments when the words recede, and in the silence, I contemplate the one being, the fountainhead of my being and every being, the light invisible to every eye except the inner one. Sometimes during those moments, realizations come to me about people I should contact, attitudes I should work to change, growth I need to make, things I need to do. Sometimes on the back of my eyelids, I see energy pulsing toward me, but mostly the peace, the love, the silence. This is my get set stage, the most delicate, difficult to protect, and a valuable time of every day. Without it, burnout is inevitable, and after it, I am ready to go into action. She's a very interesting woman. She grew up in a sect of the Plymouth Brethren, which was a very rightist sect, and she's a very heavy woman. I heard her speak at one of our theological conferences in Chicago, and she battled a lot of personal pride, as well as a struggle in her marriage. She was married and had a son, and it was a very unhappy marriage. The husband was extremely domineering, and she was a free spirit, had searched for her feminist identity. And they were finally divorced, and she has now openly admitted to her being a lesbian. And it was just fascinating to watch this woman and the compassion that she had for people. And there were some folks in the audience, you know, that really took her on. They grabbed their Bibles, you know, and they said, oh, you know, what about this? And she was just so extremely loving and compassionate. And she said that out of that struggle, she came to realize that the will of God was to create a new world, a new humanity, in Christ's reign for peace, a mutuality on a global scale. That, she said, I believe is the will of God. And she was talking about acceptance and reciprocal learnings from one another. And I think that was so appropriate for our Rainbow Week. That mutuality, not domination or ownership, but a mutuality and stewardship of one another, of the nature, and our whole perception of the world. Well, after reading this book, I did a little bit of reflecting on my own, you know, about some of my own situations of that get ready, get set, and go stage. And I have several times in my life, and maybe you can share some of those later on, where that get ready, set, and go stage was very clear to me. And one of those times was going back to India, or going to India from the U.S. And the get ready stage was just frantic, was very practical. We needed all the tools. We had to prepare for 7 years of being away from the U.S. where we could get just about everything. I had Marie, was a little baby of 3 months, so we had to take clothing for her for like 7 years. I did so. But all of that preparation. We studied Sanskrit in mission school. We studied the geography of India. We studied Hinduism. We studied all about missionaries, you know, going to Africa and maybe the things that we would have to deal with in a foreign country. So, and we had shots and we got our visas and our passport and all that get readiness, you know, for finally crossing that very difficult cultural barrier. And once we got to India, even though we were studying Tamil, That was probably another piece of the get ready stage. I see that year as kind of a year of get set, a year of silence, because I remember it as a time of tremendous vulnerability, like I talked about in my very first session, and of listening to some new messages, and of creating some new images in my mind about this country that was to be my home for 7 years. So it was really a silent period for us. And I think the country of India also gives you the context for that silence. It's a very silent, meditative country, at least overall, when you feel the atmosphere as young. When we settled into our bungalow, I think the hardest thing for me to get used to was that between 2 and 4 every afternoon, the country shut down, literally shut down. The tea shops were closed, and the only thing that you could hear in the heat of the day were the crowing of the huge crows that circled over looking for some dead rodent or something like that, and the bullock carts that went down the road, and they always had, we called them chakrams. They were little tiny metal jingles so that if these bullock carts would pass through the Indian roads at night, no wild animal would come near these carts. But that became the sound in the silence of India. A very memorable thing for me, because we had come from an apartment in St. Louis on a very busy street where the horns were honking all the time, and we were used to extreme busyness. And I think that that was a period of silence that had to develop over a whole year. My reactions to this country that were so strange needed to be silenced into my becoming at least an attempt to become one with my surroundings and my new home and my new people. Another just very quick example, at my wedding, I was 23, and I was standing in the aisle getting ready to go into the church, and you know, everything was done, all the receptions and all the speakers were in place. You know how hectic that is at a time of a wedding? And I had a mother who was a real maverick. She always took the other tack, you know. And I was standing, getting ready, actually, to go into the church, and she had not been ushered in yet. She's a little tiny woman, about 5 feet. And she walked up to me and she said, "Are you ready?" You know, I mean, I just almost fell apart, because I knew exactly what she was saying. She was not saying, you know, the reception is all done and are the speakers in place and do you have your dress nice? She was saying, have you worked out the gift that is going to be given to you in this marriage? And have you worked out the things that you might meet with your mate? You know, it was just such an incredible thing for her to say. And as I was preparing for this talk with you, I thought about that and I thought, What a woman she was, you know, to raise that up and to remind me of that. And I guess we could relate that kind of situation to almost anything that we attempt. Are you ready? And are you ready to enter a period of silence where you can assimilate and think about and reevaluate and reflect on the things that have gone before? And just one other, and that is, I have two sons that are in music. And their album is coming out, by the way, under Warner Brothers' label at the end of this month. They're called PM, and their single is being played on the radio now in St. Louis, and in fact, across the country. It's been a real exciting thing in Europe, Australia, Japan. It's been very nice. And I was talking to my son, who was in the group before I left, just on this topic, you know, and to get some ideas. And he said, you know, I've just been going crazy these days. He said, they write their own tunes, and they're already working on their second album. And he said, we sometimes just pull out whole stories before we can even get to the core of our lyrics. And he said, you know, I am at a point right now in my life where we have just gotten ready so much that I need to spiritually pull back and start thinking about what is this in my life, you know? So it's just another example of how each and every one of us goes through those periods, and hopefully we will go through the wholesome cycle of getting ready, getting set, and then moving into action. And the other thing I want to say is that was hard then. You know, as we moved from the U.S. into India, you signed, it was kind of easy eventually to move into that silent period because it was a very healing time. But then to come back and get into this rat race again was, in fact, someone who was in my first class said, "Are you going to say anything about readjusting to the culture here?" And I think that was the hardest because you know what we do here in the U.S.? We knock this one out. We get ready and we go. 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 And we just do that over and over. And it leads to our burnout. It leads to our depression and to a lack of meaning and purpose and fulfillment in our lives. And then we wonder what's wrong. Isn't that true? Do I reflect what happens in our lives here in the U.S.? And that was just so hard, you know, to continually be just always getting ready. And I had had some help in India. We had help in the home. And that's very necessary there. It also is a way for them to go into the marketplace that is way into the town. You have to buy your meat just fresh off of the racks, and it has to be slashed and cut. And it was a very helpful thing for us to have Indian people helping us in that sense. I lost my train of thought. But what was I talking about? The fact that when we got back home, here I had these eight children, you know, and they had, half of them, all of them in fact, except three, had been in the boarding situation. They had to go to school 400 miles away up in the hills of Kodaikanal. At 6 and a half they left. And so I really had three children at home. And that was, it was a kind of a heartrending thing, you know, to send them off every year for 9 months. And so I thought, oh, what a happy thing, you know, to have these, all my children with me. But little did I know, you know, what kind of incredible work this was going to be. And so here I was just making 8 lunches a day, and then my husband took his lunch too, and eventually I learned, hey, they can make their own lunches, you know. But it was a process of readjusting, you know, to that period here in the States. And so I really had to learn again to take those times of silence, and after the kids left, not to dig into my housework, but to sit and meditate. And you know, it's a memory I have of my mother as a 4-year-old running around the house. I was the youngest of 11 kids, and my next sister was 5 years older. And I remember the house was a mess. You know, the dishes were in the sink, and everything was just in turmoil. And there she was, this little woman, and she sat by the window, and she would read. And I loved it. I loved it. I mean, I didn't care about the mess, but I loved having my mother in a time of silence. And I think that's something that we have lost. We have lost. And we need to recapture that. And I'm still working at it. And I'm sure that all of you are too. I'm still working at it. Something I noted here about my time of silence in the India context was another learning I think is real helpful to pass on to you too. And that was that in that learning process, you know, it isn't only getting used to the physical things about India, but it's getting used to the possibility that there are going to be some new truths from a people that you feel don't know as much as you do, from the Hindu religion, from other people of other denominations there. And, you know, that was one thing coming out of a very orthodox, doctrinally sound Missouri Synod. You go out to a country like that with some pretty preconceived notions, and then to realize that you're vulnerable to these new truths. And this is the way Virginia Mollenkott expresses that. She says, it is fearful to accept the possibility that truth can come to one from any source.
other than one which had the Protestant version of an imprimatur upon it. I thought that was a nice way of putting it, that only your own kind of people really can give you the truth, or that truth could come to people of other religions without their conscious cognitive acceptance of the doctrines of the Christian faith. You know, that really is a profound statement. And I realized that that was a part of my pain in that first year, too, of knowing that I could not shut out those truths that I was learning from other people. And I think that that's what Holden is about, too, that we are here learning truths from other people. And especially in Rainbow Week, I think that that is so very, very true. I think the other thing that would be well for us to think about, that people are all different in dealing with this process. There are people who are perpetually getting ready. Is that true? They are perpetually getting ready. And don't we in the church form committees to do another study? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that, we do it all the time, that people are wanting to get ready. And there are others who just seem to be struggling spiritually all the time, introspecting, wondering who they are, where are we going, where have I come from, and they never are quite able to move off of the pot. You know, and well, it is a certain sense of that. And there are some people that need to do that. And then there are the movers, the people that just drive you crazy. They don't even think about anything. They just go, go, go. And they're the first ones in the women's organization who don't want to talk about purpose. They say, let's get it on. Let's get it on the road here. And, you know, I remember that especially, and as I think about my most recent involvements in planning for the new church and planning for the new women's organization and the new commission, I think that was our biggest struggle, that when we sat down and our first processes were to get our 8 coordinating council members together from Women in Action for Mission, from the ELC. They were really the only ones we had in a national leadership, together with staff people from the ALC women, their staff, and then from the LCA women. That struggle was the hardest. We had 6 sessions, I think. And it was interesting to watch how some of us came out of the AELC, which was the breakoff of Missouri, and we were in a movement process. We were looking for change in people. And how could we change the attitudes, the behaviors, and the practices of the church itself, by how we saw ourselves as women and how we addressed the functions and the doctrines of the church. And I would say that the larger traditional organizations were more, they did that too, and I don't intend to deny that, but they were more go-getters. You know, let's get on with the job. And that is the point at which we had some drag-out fights. And every time we processed the agenda, there were 3 of us, myself and Bonnie Jenser from the ALC and Lois Loeffler from LCA, that were the core agenda setters. And even in our small group, it's just fortunate that we loved each other so much. But I tell you, we just hassled about this thing. You know, how do we get people to think about where they have been? And what do those learnings mean as you move into a new arena? Are we just going to recreate the wheel again and recreate the same women's organizations? And which doesn't mean they were all bad, but we were entering into a new era. We chucked some baggage. And I would say those were some of the hardest things. And the planning committee of 70, the commission for a new Lutheran church, those were some of the periods and the points at which they had some of the most controversy. What is our purpose? What kind of church does the Lord call us to be? Not just where's the pension fund, you know, what's the pension fund and how much is our budget going to be, but you'd be surprised how many people that's where they rest. That's where their final goal rests. As long as they have that in place, oh, that'll all come later. Everything can happen. Instead of saying, if we have our focus clear, what kind of church we want God to gift us with, and what is our part in that, it makes a tremendous difference how you define the budget. What does it go for?
That's right.
Isn't that right, Joe?
Yeah.
Who are the assistant to the bishop in Detroit. And so it's a struggle that we go through continually. And I think I'd like us to struggle a little bit now, too. And I'd like to pose some questions for you to talk about in terms of where you see yourself. Where do you see yourself in this cycle? I'm sure that many of us see us in either two or in all the arenas. You know, we could write our names in a circle around here or in one or the other of those places. And just reflect on that. I don't know if we're going to share that particular aspect of it either. But as you reflect on it, think about this question. Is it okay to stay in one place for you, if that's where you are? Is that an okay place to be? Or how long can we stay in one or two places without it becoming detrimental? And where do you see yourself in that process? What if we could open up some discussion on that? Are you a perpetually get-ready person or perpetually living in the silence? Yes.
Well, don't just think that you're sometimes a get-ready person in some instances, in some situations of your life, but maybe in others you're kind of shy.
Absolutely.
Or at different times in your life, different maturations.
I call that being in rhythms of our life. We have different rhythms in our lives. And I think that they get mixed up sometimes, too. I think that's what you're saying, is that the get-ready stages sometimes are broken by the silence. And before we move into action, we need to go back to getting ready again.
Well, when you were talking about being a mother, I just think about the ages of your children allow you more time for silence rather than just the action. Depending on what they're going through,
yes,
it asks different things of you.
Definitely. Okay, that's very helpful, because I think those rhythms of our lives, you know, they shift and change, and I think rather than be fearful of that, we don't ever get finished with one stage, like the ready stage, and we move into the silent stage, and then we're ready to go. That happens sometimes, I think. But I think they usually are a little bit mixed up on that. And that's a good place to be. Anybody else want to? Yeah.
I guess it may seem a little far-fetched movement from your contribution, but thinking of children and also thinking of the silent stage. From what you described, it sounds like silence is partly, there was the element of seeing the wholeness of everything. And allowing your internal thinking and talking to quiet down to feel and see the connections and to be receptive to the world. And I guess, but I wonder if that's a real crucial part of being with other people and just living in a world with other people, which is that if we're constantly in the speech action phase, then we never really hear anybody else either. And that perhaps the silent stage is also really crucial to know what other people are saying to us, you know, to give other people a chance to give ourselves a chance to be totally receptive. And the one reason I thought of it in relationship to my son is that on I think a fairly good source, recommendation from a good source, I decided to, whenever I'm with my son, to give him periods of time, like say half an hour. This half an hour is totally yours. And in that half an hour, he determines exactly what we will do. And he is the one who decides everything that happens in that half hour. If he wants to play, if he wants to yell, if he wants to beat me up, I will be, you know, creatively responsive to that. And it's an incredible time. It's very difficult to do sometimes because I have to silence my projects and my speech and my plans to find out what's going on with him. And the wonderful thing is that I do find out things that are going on with him that I would not find out otherwise if you were constantly fit into my projects for the day. Mm-hmm. This is an example of that. So.
And I think that's kind of the usual way we operate as adults, isn't it? That unless we deliberately set aside and rediscipline ourselves in that aspect, that we do fit children into our own agendas, and they better fit or else. You know, that's often the feeling I think that we have. Is that anybody else would like to share? Jim?
I think so often we do this with people, too. We like to
real important, I think, to make that journey from get ready, get set, go, to make that with the really, really deep relationships, real deep involvement. And I was thinking of the way in which you and Jim made your journey together, hand in hand. And it was perhaps perceived by people who knew you well. And Jim was way out there in the front, and he was always going like crazy. And I knew Jim's way. But not so. You were hand in hand with Jim so often. And that was the beauty of your silence, your getting ready and going. And that continues on today. The Jim spirit with you. See? And that's real important for every human being. To have that close friendship of another person and of a community, which then goes from this into the whole arena of acceptance. The acceptance of one another, where individuals are in that constant process. And there's always a growth process there. If you just sit on the pot, you will die on the pot. Or if you're constantly going, that's not healthy either.
That's
something that I shared about what I've always known and loved about you and me.
I just remember too how I think about that because Jim was a goer. You know, he was on the move. And I think he actually took his silent times while he was working because he always said he could think better. You could think better at the saw or while he was in the car alone. And I think there are people like that, you know, who really, they think very well. Those are almost silent times. So there's a little bit of a crossing over there too. But one other thing I wanted to say about India was that it was such a wonderful place where to be in terms of mapping out that get ready, set and go stage. I remember that I had worked out for myself a regular program for the day. I was afraid I would dry up mentally, literally. You know, you get into another culture and all of your, I was a literature major in college, you know, and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I really have to keep my mind going. And so I had myself a very set program which I could do and totally lost it when I came to the States. I read Luther in the morning. I mean, I just made myself read some theology. And in the afternoon, during that wonderful siesta time, I would read Shakespeare. I just made myself do that. And in the evening, I read Imprint, which was all the fiction that came out of India. It was just wonderful. And I did that every day. And you know, I got to the States, and I just lost it. You know, in all that go, go, go. And Judy, I'm sorry, I wanted to say that.
No. I was just going to say that I say the action stage is the most vulnerable. And depending on our personalities, if we aren't willing to risk, if we aren't willing to fail, to feel pain, we can get stuck in the get ready, get set, and then do nothing for fear.
That's really true. That's very helpful. And I think, Marie, it was you that said, as we were talking about this at home, that the support you need the most sometimes is, you didn't say the action, but you said in that get ready stage too, sometimes the getting ready is so overwhelming. Marie happens to be rehabbing a huge house and she's doing it on her own, you know, and she just said in that period of time. So there are the various, I think, stages where one finds that you need the support and that action stage too, taking that risk of moving. Yes, anybody else?
I was just looking at your, I'm not sure why you do that circle on the inside. If you're
completing
the pot there. I was relating to it and thinking that, you know, one of my struggles is I go between speech and silence, I think, and the action is expected of me, and so I do the action, but it seems like it never comes out of my being or out of, you know, that there's never sort of a pure action that comes out of my person, but it's, I can do the busyness or I can do what's expected. Those actions are done. And I think there is sort of an inner circle of speech, silence, and action. And I want to get in touch with that too, so that the action really flows out of my being rather than out of my role or whatever that is.
That's interesting. That's
really helpful. No, the reason I do that, I was going to put a few names.
Oh, okay.
I was going to ask you where you fitted yourself, and I thought there might be some. So oh, it really doesn't belong there.
Well, don't erase it because it's my picture now.
Okay. All right, let's leave it in there.
Okay. Yes.
I was observing that I find myself, and I think it's probably true for most clergy, that we think when we've spoken, that's the action.
Interesting.
Uh-oh.
You know, that the sermon is the doing instead of the screwing up the courage to present it to our administrative council or whoever it is we present it to at the church is the doing of it rather than the getting ready, you know.
That's so true. That's helpful. Anybody else? Marie?
I think coming up in the Lutheran background, well, I don't know if it's particularly Lutheran, maybe it's just my family, but constantly getting...
Talk a little bit louder.
Constantly getting ready, and, or maybe it was, I think it was mostly getting ready, having to do things that don't particularly go anywhere with their busyness, and the silence is not valued. And I think over these past years, I had to tell myself over and over that, you know, the silence is valuable, and it doesn't really... And also to give myself permission how long I need the silence, and that there is still, that when I'm ready to, that the silence, like you said, you feel like you are compelled to get to the action stage, so you can go ahead maybe before you're ready. And that in the silence, you know, when I'm in silence, I'm still taking in the support of other people, maybe those who are in the action stage. And like you said, the action is maybe just it's not a sermon, but the act of love of somebody accepting your silence.
Okay.
I like what we said about giving yourself permission to take that time for silence, because I think we have a tendency to that the action is what is success-oriented. And we look at society as being, well, I have to be busy all the time to appear successful or be successful. And I struggle with that all the time because I like those quiet times. And it's like, oh, no, do I really deserve that time when I have these, maybe I have active children and working. You know, it's real hard. It's very, very difficult to take the time. And you think of yourself as a giving person. I know a lot of teachers who work in the schools, and they think they're all constantly giving and giving to children at home, and they, I have to keep giving more to feel like, you know, to be compassionate, but they never really take the time for themselves to allow any kind of healing or, you know, regrouping. And I see that all the time, but how can I take that time?
And not feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
You'll give yourself permission to do it. Oh, that's very helpful. Yes, there was somebody back there, and then you. Yes.
I think silence is really scary.
Pardon?
I find silence to be very scary.
Scary.
I think I skip that stage more often than not because I don't know that I want to sit down and look at myself. And I even act that out in the house when I'm home alone. The house is never silent. Even TV on or the radio, I have to have some noise. And I have to really teach myself that it's okay to be just with myself, with that silence. But it's sort of frightening.
That's very, very helpful. And that reflects a lot of what I'm feeling now with all the kids out of the house, too. I think that was the hardest thing after my husband's death, was to come, especially from retreats like this, where we had often done them together, and to go walk into the silence of a home, you know, and not have anybody to share with them. And really, and you're so right, to learn to enjoy yourself, you know, and to say, I'm a whole person. That's very helpful. Yes. Yes. And you had something to say.
Oh, I'm not sure I can articulate, but I guess one thing I've been learning here at Wyvern is I feel because I'm constantly bombarded with people, and I came here to be alone and silent and contemplate, which I've done none of at all, period. Yeah, it hasn't been any loss. I've realized there's something about being silent with people. I feel like when we run into people, our reaction is, I talk and you talk and I talk and you talk and we leave. And so often somebody needs just a person to be silent with them. And, you know, we don't do a lot of that. We do a lot of even being with the person involves speech. And it's been a real neat thing for me to sort of slow down. I was thinking about Jim Cushman, the guy with cerebral palsy.
Oh, yes.
He's slow. And in order to talk to him, you have to say, here's a half hour of my day's shot. That would be what a wee quick thing.
Ordinarily, yeah.
I've got to talk for half an hour here now instead of my normal minute. And it's been a really, you know.
Those are good insights, too. Really good. Yes.
One of the things that I've appreciated about three or four times, and I really feel the need to do it again, I have gone to the Jesuit Center near Reading, Pennsylvania for an 8-day silent retreat. And the first couple of days is kind of scary, getting into the silence, but I have really found the power of that in getting in touch with myself.
It's a good place to do it at a seminary like that. I guess that's really what retreats are for. You know, so many congregations have weekend retreats where people can get back into just the thinking and the reflecting. And I think also that they have been learning to put into the agenda an actual time where nothing happens and you go into your room or whatever. Thanks. And Carol, you were going to say
something. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm sort of reflecting up here as I weave away, because I think pretty freely when I'm weaving, sort of therapeutic. But it occurs to me that we've had, in the last 5 years, maybe even more, a plethora of books on spirituality, which it's almost a fad word, but it still reflects, I think, something that is perceived as a lack in American Christian or otherwise living. And It amuses me a bit, and I find myself having the same kind of trouble. It amuses me a bit that, you know, book after book will say, well, you will set this whole thing up. You have a favorite chair that you sit in, and but it's always, so what do I fill the silence with? You can't just sit, you know, you have to pray, or you have to image, and part of me is struggling with, what does the silence mean? Is it reflection? Is it emptying? I remember when I was teaching in an alternative school, a bunch of my students wanted to get into, as they said, yoga, and they wanted me to come and join this class. Well, okay, I said I would come and be part of their class one day. And so there some of them were showing off that they could sit in this incredibly difficult position of knees and legs wrapped around. Well, I couldn't quite manage that, but I sat cross-legged, and this was on a floor. It was hard, and we were all supposed to be quiet for, I don't know, 10 minutes, which is a long time for people who aren't used to being quiet for a minute, you know. And then we were supposed to share this, whatever we were supposed to do, empty our thoughts completely. And I couldn't empty my thoughts, and so I ended up praying for my students, which is probably pretty good, you know. But what I remember is that then they asked me, well, what did you think? And I said, well, frankly, my ankle hurt because it was on cement. And then I prayed for you, and they were startled with that. But you know, what preoccupation I have in the whole American culture has with, okay, so silence, so then what do you do in that silence? Are you supposed to think or empty or read scripture or pray? Or, you know, what is it that we're supposed to do? And the very fact that we end up talking about, questioning what is it we're supposed to do, says something about our discomfort with
That's right.
mm-hmm. the silence.
That really is true. And as you were talking, I was reflecting on my own periods of silence that I have already just sat, you know, just sat and thought.
And then we worry that we didn't get anything accomplished.
Yeah, I know. That's so true. Anybody else? Yeah.
Well, this discussion seems to have gone toward the one of the three up there in silence, which is the one I'm most comfortable with. And I spent quite a bit of time at a church in Washington, D.C. working with silence. And one of the experiences that was most profound to me, we during silent weekends, and this one was led by a Jesuit priest who teaches people to add 20 minutes of centering prayer, which is silent prayer, doing nothing, into their daily routines, and it was done very well. And it was done so that I was able to do nothing for 20 minutes. We were supposed to become like Teflon pans, so any thoughts came in, we could just let them go. And what came to me that was just, you know, an aha, was that it felt like the first time that I had done anything unconditionally. I struggle with that, you know, conditional stuff all my life, and I was just sitting there doing nothing, you know. If I wanted to pray to be better, that I let that go, or if I wanted to pray for the world, I let that go, or anything. And you know, you just are stripped down, and you're not getting anything done at all. I was not feeling like I was getting anything done, and it was just unconditional. So that was real.
That's helpful.
Yeah. Well, is there anybody else that would like to say anything on this point here? Yeah.
Well, I think, I'm not sure exactly why, maybe because of the way we've been brought up, but I think that silence is maybe hard for us too, because it's also a time, it's also the place where feelings are more present. And I think that we have a pretty strong bias in this culture against feelings, you know, that it does get uncomfortable when you're just with someone silent, and because I think in some sense your only vehicle then is the feelings that you have. And I think often, I mean, if you think about our schooling, for example, I mean, it's one of the most drastic conditionings away from feelings and towards constant speech and action. You are constantly, you know, getting something done. You're constantly reading something. If you should cry or laugh too loud or maybe, you know, get too scared or get too angry in a school, you know, it's under current conditions, you know, teachers generally feel that it's not handleable. You know, you can't run a school that way. And yet, you know, maybe we should ask ourselves whether it's so important for us to get these things done that we're not going to allow ourselves to have deep feelings about the world. And I think that gradually we shut off that space, and that that's partly, I think, what is scary about stopping everything, about stopping the speech and stopping the action, is that we have this buildup of things that we haven't had a chance to really feel.
Yeah. Those things have been very helpful, and as I come to the end of this particular, my fourth out of five preparations, I'm really reflecting on my own getting ready for these things, you know. My children keep telling me, your experiences are so rich, you know, in what you already have experienced in your history, that to feel that the only thing that legitimizes that is some in-depth study or something of that nature. You know, you always try to legitimize where you're coming from. It's been a real helpful learning for me. And of course, I've made a lot of speeches at conventions and conferences where you know, you have that audience and it's a one-time shot, but I don't think I've ever had the experience or the privilege of dialoguing with people like this. And it's been a real skill learning process for me. And I think I'm learning, but it's been very helpful, and I appreciate your helping me too. And I hope you have a good day. Thank you.